You know the way these stories go. 13 years ago, 4 struggling musicians made a deal with the devil. What were they chasing? Fame, riches, adoration. All your classic devil fare. What happened next? Well, you know the way these stories go. The damned fools got it in their heads to try and outrun their end of the bargain. Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon, the tabletop role-playing podcast that helps game masters learn new games and make each one better than the last. My name is Brian Flaherty, and I'm joined by the one, the only, Elliot Davis.
Hello!
And this right here is a special sponsored miniseries that is being released in time with the Backerkit campaign for a game that we are very, very excited about called Last Train to Bremen. This game is a tragedy for a doomed quartet of musicians who made a deal with the devil and are trying and failing to outrun their fate. This game has everything that we love in a role-playing game. Lots of flavor, innovative mechanics, and the devil incarnate. What more could you possibly want from a game? And to help us get ready to play Last Train to Bremen, we are talking to the game designer, Caro Assertion, who will teach us the rules and will prepare us to tell the best Doom story that we can. Caro, thanks so much for joining us.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be on the show.
It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
So happy to have you.
A really, really cool game.
Thanks.
You've made several really cool games, in fact, and this is just the latest in that lineage.
So I gave a little pitch at the top, but could you tell us and the audience in your own words, what is Last Train to Bremen?
Yeah, like you said, Last Train to Bremen is a tragedy for a doomed quartet. It is 4 musicians trying to outrun the devil. The basic pitch that I always like to give folks is it's Faust and it's Fleetwood Mac. Those are kind of the two big, like, you know, if you have the one thing and the other thing and you'd combine them together, those are the two. The thing that I think you've spoken to is these characters are running from their, you know, their cursed contract with the devil. They've hopped onto a boxcar. You know, they've snuck onto a train. The train is hurtling to the one place they think they'll never get caught. And there is nothing to do inside of that train except sit and stare at each other and while away the hours and point fingers about whose fault it is that they wound up in this situation. So it's really a game that is trying to be both a bottle episode and a series of flashbacks. It's these characters saying, well, how did we get into this mess in the first place?
Man, Faust plus Fleetwood Mac is such a great selling point. that's when you know it's going to get messy in the best way.
Oh, 100%.
I'm curious, where did this game start for you? Where did the inspiration come to make it?
Yeah, there are a couple of different conception points where I can say, like, oh, this is like the thing that really helped crystallize it. I'll go through them in order of like most recent to oldest. I think the most clear point that I can say, oh, this is when I had the full idea for the game was in 2023, I was attending Big Bad Con, and I had the opportunity to playtest a couple of games that were using pre-generated characters in a really interesting way and established, like, oh, these are games that are, there is something really interesting here about pre-gens, right? I haven't done that in any of the other games I've designed. It's definitely not a space that I tend to play in as a player, but particularly one game that I was playtesting, The Prince of Nothing Good by C.J. Linton, helped me crystallize, oh, I understand what the appeal of pregens is here. I kind of want to try something in this space now. And the other thing that happened at Big Bad Con was I was sitting around with a couple designers at one point. We were just like chatting over lunch. And I was like, okay, we've got a little bit of time before all of our next games or our panels or things. We don't want to go into like a full RPG. Let's just play some Liar's Dice. So we just like pulled out all of our dice and played. And I was like, oh, this is a good mechanical framework, which kind of goes into one of the other conception points, which is like I learned Liar's Dice as a kid and would play it backstage when I was doing student theater in high school with the other like stage crew technicians. And we were like, okay, we're bored. We need something to do to pass the time. Let's just pull out these dice and play. And there is something about that game in particular that's like, oh, this is quick. It's fairly easy to learn. Once you have an understanding of what the mechanics are, it kind of jumps in and pulls you into it very quickly. And so those two points were really the biggest points of inspiration. I guess the third was The Town Musicians of Bremen as a folktale, which is one that I've always kind of held a little bit of a fascination with. It's sort of a fairy tale. It's sort of a folktale. It's an interesting one that it's not necessarily magical in quite the same way, but it's always captured my attention. And it was like, what if there was a game that also kind of incorporated this into the Faustian bargain and kind of the retelling in that way? So kind of take all of those ingredients and put them into a pot.
I don't actually know the folktale.
I don't either. I was going to ask, what is that?
Yeah, so this is a German folktale. I think it might be part of Hans Christian Andersen's original like catalog. I might be mistaken there. But the premise is it is four animals, the cockerel, the cat, the hound, and the mule, which might be familiar to folks who know the game, who work on a farm and basically realize, hey, we're obsolete. Like, we're getting older in our years. We're not able to do the jobs that this farmer hired us for. And so they decide they're going to leave the farm and become musicians and go to Bremen and sing for their supper and earn their fortune in the big city. And then some classical folktale, you know, folklore shenanigans happen. They get sidetracked. They run into robbers. They scare the robbers off. And the story ends with them not actually reaching Bremen because they find another house. And it's like, oh, the four of us don't actually need to be these famous musicians. We just, you know, need each other and have that kind of community of the four of them, which is, I think, often, like, I think that's lighter than a lot of classical folktales end up ending, right? But yeah,
for sure.
But the premise of, like, oh, there's these four talking animals who decide we want to become musicians, right? We want to become famous, was always something that was kind of sat in the back of my mind. And I landed on a couple of years ago this idea of, like, what happens if you cross that with the Faustian bargain? And that idea kind of just sat in the back of my mind until, 2023, when I playtested, you know, at that Big Bad Con. I was playing Liar's Dice, and I was like, oh, this is the game. This is how these pieces all come together. And from there, it was actually a really quick writing process just to, like, get the first draft and be like, oh, here are these four characters. They're based on these animals, which makes it very easy to have, like, personality and all of these things that are attached to it, and just like dive into playing out the messy fallout of this interpersonal band drama, right?
That's great. I love folklore. I love just like folklore as inspiration for game design. I feel like it's something we've heard from other designers sometimes. It's just like there's something so immediately evocative about like some of the art that Connor has done for the new book and for the original game, of just these four faces. You're just like, man, I know who those are immediately without knowing anything else about them. It's so good. I love that.
Yeah, and you know, it is worth going. It's worth saying, right, that the folklore is drawing on that, you know, German folktale that I was talking about. There's also a lot of Americana in here, right? You think about Robert Johnson and like classic American crossroads mythology, you know, blues music, folk music, deals with the devil are there is a lot of cross-cultural pollination that is happening in this book, and I'd be remiss not to like name that out front as another huge source of inspiration and a touchstone.
I remember the first time I heard the like story behind Robert Johnson, like first listened to King of the Delta Blues singers and that whole album. It's just like that really captures my imagination of like meeting the devil at the crossroad, making that deal. It has a very particular Americana vibe that is, you know, Route 66 dusty etched things that feels like it's really like pushed into this game in a great way.
100%.
So I feel like the thing that's fascinating to me about this game is that like thematically there is an inherent hostility between the characters from Jump. And I'm curious, like, what are the, like, when you were thinking about the themes you wanted to put into this game, like, what are the themes at the core of Bremen?
Yeah, I mean, really that interpersonal tension is a huge part of it. I realized as I was making the game, and now that it's been out for a bit and I've like had, you know, opportunities to talk about it, it's like, oh, this game is in a lot of ways about the intimacy of being very close creative collaborators with people for a very long time and like learning what their tics are, learning what your tics are, learning how you work together, and learning the ways that you don't. Because, you know, no creative collaboration, no creative partnership is going to be 100% perfect. And so when you bump into somebody else and it's like, oh, this is actually a, you know, fundamental disagreement that we have in terms of how we approach our process or what our, you know, personal beliefs are about how we're coming to the work. How do you reconcile that? Or in Bremen's case, what happens when you can't, when those are so fundamentally different that it is impossible to kind of square those beliefs, right? And so it's about that. It's about looking back at, you know, is there any way that we could have done this differently? And yeah, realizing, okay, maybe there is, but in order to come out differently, we would have had to be different people from the jump. And, you know, that sounds very tragic. And I think it's also very beautiful, right? It's like, okay, the reason that we are creative collaborators, I think, you know, tabletop games as a very collaborative medium and theater as a collaborative medium, right, are such, you have to have multiple people. You can't do it alone, right? That is part of the joy of the work and part of the reason that we are doing this is because we want to be able to have that moment of collaboration with others. And so it's about really navigating the friction between those two truths, I would say.
So my first dungeon is all about preparing game masters to take on a new game and like help them get out of their own way and help them be set up for success. But this is a GM-less system, which is something we haven't done a lot of on this show before. We played Wander Home and we played Yzeva's Bed and Breakfast, but kind of a guided Yzeva's Bed and Breakfast rather than a true GM-less game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So normally this is the part of the show where we'd ask the GM to say like what they're nervous about, what is making them, what is stopping them from picking this game up and playing it. But because there's not a GM, we've got to kind of change the format of the show on the fly here. So I'd love to hear from you before we dive into mechanics and building characters and the nitty gritty of the game. When you were playtesting this game, when you're playing this game with new players who haven't tried it before, where are the points that new players have the most difficulty or where there's like kind of a hitch in their giddy up, which is apparently a phrase I've started saying now? and where are the moments where things flow the best? And how do we get from those moments that might trip a new player up to them flowing through this game as easily and breezily as possible?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when I've playtested, I think the areas that tend to be the most, I wouldn't even call it a sticking point. I think it's just and making sure that players are on the wavelength about this is what these things are supposed to do, this is how these mechanics fit with each other, is memories, which getting into the specific mechanics, the game is played, like we've been saying, using Liar's Dice. As players give up dice, Liar's Dice is an elimination game, right? So you're wagering and players are losing dice. So as players lose dice, they get narrative control. They get to narrate a memory between their character and another character in the band and say like, oh, this is a flashback to a time when, you know, we were having an argument or the time we first met or a moment where we, you know, shared this connection. And I think the thing that players sometimes do, I think there's, you know, I've tried to reframe it a little bit, is making room for players to find their own voice within those memories and get into, oh, this is what my character is thinking, and balancing that with the narration of, oh, this is what this moment is supposed to, you know, how this is reinforcing the tension between the two of us, right? And part of that is like, the way that I've tried to smooth that over in the game is offering some like very specific advice around, here's how to frame memories, here's how to like what tips you should be aiming for, here's the things you should be looking for, because they're not quite traditional scenes, right? I think a lot of times when we are thinking about, oh, here's how you frame a scene, it is a very like, you want to make room for the other person, you want to, you know, have some of that yes and the in-character dialogue back and forth. Memories aren't necessarily that. Memories are, this is one character, they are speaking their truth. They're saying, this is what I remember about this moment between the two of us. And they kind of say that, and they end their truth. And then the other character gets to butt in and say, yeah, but I remember that differently, right? It's not necessarily, there isn't necessarily room for that in-character dialogue within the memories in that way, which is not to say that you can't. You know, I think there are definitely folks who can play and have played and make room for that. But I find that the interpersonal character relationships of like, oh, there's actually back and forth happening between these is best saved for like the banter that is happening when you're doing the liar's dice portion of it, right?
Yeah, what is that? I guess like in imagining, so the memories are one. When we're just rolling dice, like when we're shaking our cups and we're getting ready to play liar dice, like how much have you seen people lean into like, we're in character this whole time, we're role playing through playing liar's dice, or how much do you see people go in and out when it comes to like, we're in a memory, we're in role play, when we're shaking the dice, we're above the table?
It's interesting, right? Like the way that the way this game is constructed is there are two layers to it, like you're speaking to. There's liar's dice, and then there's, you know, the fiction that is being superimposed on top of liar's dice, right? Which you could just play a straight game of liar's dice and that would be perfectly, you know, a fun and enjoyable experience in its own right. I think what we've tried to do, I've tried to thread the needle on here, is not necessarily having players think, oh, how would I wager in character, right? It's when you're playing liar's dice, I think there is a very easy impulse to fall into, what is the thing that I, Caro, as a player, am going to wager in this moment so that I can win the round, right? Or make it through the round and knock somebody else out. And I think what happens is kind of a weird alchemy where it's not actually, that layer isn't happening in character as Hound or Mule or whichever character I'm playing, right? That is happening in my own like personal psychology. And so then when it's time to switch out of that, it's like, oh, I can use the adversarial nature of the fact that we've been playing liar's dice, which is inherently a competitive game, and maybe I lose the hand and I'm like, oh, I'm feeling really spiteful, I'm going to channel that spite into the scene that I'm then narrating, right? You know, playfully spiteful, right? It's not like, oh, I'm actually, yeah.
I really love a game that allows you to move so fluidly in like above and below the table, like into and out of gameplay, because like you said, it's we as players are playing liar's dice and our characters are also playing liar's dice or like are passing at the same time, and having that clear link between player and character is really, I hadn't really thought about that being an exciting part of the game as I was reading the game, but now I'm like, ooh, that actually really scratches an itch that I didn't know I had. This is great.
Yeah, and it's not seamless, right? Like, there's still, you have to have that little cognitive, like, flip in the brain where it's like, okay, I'm playing the strategy of liar's dice. Now I have to get back into character, right? But what we've tried to do is really grease the wheels of that transition to smooth it over as much as we possibly can.
It's not often that RPGs are inherently like put you in a situation where you're like, oh, our characters are mad at each other and are going to be mad at each other a lot in this game. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, safety tools and stuff on this show before. For people who maybe aren't used to that kind of like PvP role play where it's like, no, we're gonna get into a little bit of like, hey, you fucked me over this one time, you ruined this gig for us, like what advice would you give to like people who are like, oh, I'm a little hesitant about like getting into that and like being a little mean in character to my friends?
I think part of it is setting the expectation up front, right? It's like, okay, we know that these characters are going to be at each other's throats, right? There's going to be things where it's like we're bumping up against each other. I think there are ways to have a conversation around like, oh, I might not actually want to veer into like this particular like kind of interpersonal friendship, or like there's friction about how we're delving into the specifics of, like, you know, these two members of the band hooking up and having a messy fallout and the way that that impacts everybody else, or, you know, getting into the specifics about, you know, how money comes into it when you're doing a creative project that is also part of an industry, right? And so really, I think the biggest thing is having a frank conversation and making sure that everybody at the table knows, like, oh, this is where our lines are, right? What are the things that we don't actually want to delve into specifically? And recognizing where those moments of friction happen if they do happen in play.
Cyber Plus Punk Overload is the first official expansion for the award-winning, ultra-stylish, rules-light cyberpunk game, Cyber Plus Punk, that is specifically designed for action-packed one-shot sessions. In Cyber Plus Punk, you are a runner, a merc, a criminal, an activist living on the edge and running in the shadows of a gritty, ultra-violent world. Infiltrate a mega prison, escape a bloody reality show, solve a time loop, race vehicles in the Badlands, or escape the Netscape. One-shot scenarios, gear catalogs, plug-in rule sets, and complete settings made by an all-star cast of game designers and stylishly bundled into three sleek thematic packs. So go back Cyber Plus Punk Overload on Kickstarter to get the limited edition version with a slick hollow foil sleeve. Just search CBR plus PNK colon Overload on Kickstarter. That's CBR plus PNK colon Overload.
Hi, I'm Maia, and this is Maia's Game Room, a narrative actual play anthology featuring short-form, story-driven TTRPGs. Each season tells a new story using a different rules-light system brought to life with sound design, editing, and emotional-rich roleplay. So, if you love cinematic storytelling and character-driven drama, come check out Season 1, set in the haunting world of the Electric State RPG. Just search Maia's Game Room wherever you get your podcasts.
We've been talking a lot about Liar's Dice and the mechanics of this game, and I think it is time we actually dive into the mechanics of Liar's Dice. And for anyone who hasn't played Liar's Dice or isn't familiar with it, if you've seen Pirates of the Caribbean 2, you remember the scene where they play as Liar's Dice. But the game isn't actually fully explained even in that movie. So, Carol, can you give us a brief primer on what Liar's Dice is and how to play it?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, every person I know, when I bring in Liar's Dice, they're like, oh, my touchstone for that is Pirates of the Caribbean 2, which I had never actually seen. I'd never watched that scene until after I was playing the game. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, this is interesting. And there's actually, like, also a really interesting psychology of, like, how those characters are playing against each other. But Liar's Dice, for anybody who doesn't know, is a gambling game. It's a bluffing game. It's a game of chance. The way that it works is every player at the table has a pool of dice. It's the same number of dice for each player. In Last Train to Bremen, that's 3, but you can play with, everybody has five dice, everybody has six dice. There's variants and variations. And the way that it works is one player will make a wager that of all of the dice on the table, you know, say that there's the three of us are playing and each of us has five dice. So there's 15 dice on the table. I might say, of those 15 dice, you know, I know how many I have in my hand and what their values are. Let's say four of them are threes, right? So I might start with something like four threes. And Elliot, you could look at your hand and say, okay, based on that wager, I think there are five threes or six threes. Or you could go up and say, I think there are four fours or four fives or four sixes. And so everybody is raising and increasing the number of the value of the dice or the number of dice that there are in their wager until we get to the point that somebody says, you know, I don't think that there are 12 sixes on the table. I'm going to call you out. And then we all reveal our hands. We count up what the values are and we see whether, you know, the person who made the call has made their wager, or the person who called the bluff has kind of proved them wrong. And the loser between those two people loses a die. And then you repeat until folks get eliminated. But as you go down in dice, you have less information. And so people are gambling and kind of placing their bets in terms of, oh, here is how much information I actually have at the table. And so there's a real strategy about how you're raising, how you're calling, and how you're reading other players in terms of the psychology. Do you think that they are calling something because of what you've previously called? Do you think that they're calling something because they actually think they have good odds? It's like poker in that way. It's about knowing the rules, and it's also about knowing the other players. And there's a lot of variants and different regionalisms and ways that people will finesse the game, which we can get into with Bremen, which has its own specific variations, right? But yeah, it's a fun game. It's a great one to pull out if you've got a handful of dice and you're just looking to pass the time with friends for, you know, half an hour.
It's an inherently fuck you game, which I love those kinds of games. Like when somebody challenges you and gets you, and or like they trick you with a good bluff. It's one of my favorite just like games to pull out in a group of people.
It's also a funny game because even just playing it not as a role-playing game, just playing Liar's Dice, a kind of pseudo story develops no matter what happens. Like there's always the person that goes on the run and becomes the target, and like there's lucky numbers that develop. Like there's always a story. It's not like a narrative story, but like narrative starts to get formed around Liar's Dice in a very weird and fun way that I always really enjoy every time I get to play it.
There's patterns, right? Anytime that you're playing a game that involves, you know, multiple people who are in sequence or in conversation with each other, and like you say, lucky numbers, right? It's like, oh, there are the same numbers are being used every time. And so it's like, oh, you know, you're calling five sixes again, even though we have fewer dice on the table, right? What happens when you end up repeating that or seeing that kind of numerology repeating itself?
And you mentioned that there's like some variations, right? So there's sometimes versions of like wild dice people use. What is the devil's die in Bremen, and how does that work?
Yeah, so the devil's die is, this is actually part of the way that I was taught Liar's Dice. So I learned afterwards there are versions of the game that don't have wild values in them. But I learned that after I'd played the game for the first time. So the devil's die is a mechanic where, you know, there's four players, they have three dice each, and that makes for 12 dice. The 13th die in the middle of the table is wild, which means that at the start of the round, the person who leads the round rolls that die out in the open where everybody can see, and say that rolls up as a one, right? That means that for this round, ones are wild. So I might say three twos, right, as the start of my wager. When somebody calls, they're going to put in all of the twos, and they're also going to put in all of the ones to kind of add those all up in the same tally, right? But if you call the wild value on the devil's die, right, you know, say I say five ones, ones stop being wild for the remainder of the round. And that means that any number, any future calls also stop being wild. So there's something really interesting in the math of, okay, I might know, you know, if the wild die is six and I have three sixes in my hand, that's four of any number, right? I can be a little bit aggro, or I could call four sixes and know that that's a wager that's going to be met, and nobody else can call the wild values, which means that they're going to have to play that. That's going to shake up their strategy in a real way.
There's a lot of fun to the calling the devil's dice. Just it feels like a kind of a fuck you to the table in a great way. And it just like immediately flips the game. Like if you're midway through and all of a sudden wilds are gone, it's like it really shakes up the game in a fun way.
Yeah,
exactly.
Everybody has to reconsider whatever they had in their hand and be like, oh, is that necessarily going to be a safe wager now? Right. The thing that's really interesting about the devil's die is like starting out, you know, you can say one of any value, right? Because there's automatically going to be one die of any value on the table. And then, yeah, the moment that somebody calls that and freezes it in place, you have to reconsider that math. It's just a fundamental shift.
So Liar's Dice is this core mechanic where we're losing dice and recalling memories. I do want to get into the characters we're playing in this. And like a lot of the inspiration for these memories comes from things on our character sheets. And then there's some stuff on our character sheets that gets revealed partway through the game. Could you tell us about, without spoilers, because this is a game with spoilers, if listeners don't know, which is very cool. I love a game with spoilers. Could you tell us about the four pre-generated characters that we're playing Liar's Dice as?
Absolutely. So, like I said, this game is based on this folktale, The Town Musicians of Bremen, right? Which has these four animals in it, a cockerel, a cat, a hound, and a mule. And this is going back to folktales. It's like, oh, these animals have so much personality baked into them from the jump, right? You know, like if you're reading folktales and you see a cockerel, it's like, oh, this character has a personality. This is it's a motif that we can jump into very, very easily. Same with a hound. A hound is, you know, a dog is loyal, right? Same with a mule is a very stubborn character. And I found that those archetypes also mapped really well onto the band archetypes, the ideas of, okay, there's a four-person band. What instruments might these characters play? How do you map these to the personalities of these animals? And also not just the instruments that they're playing, but the other parts of the band, the things like who handles the finances, who, you know, books the venues, who holds like press relations and PR and, you know, is the spokesperson, who's the band's like heart and soul, right? So the idea of these four characters having these really clear relationships with themselves and with each other came together really quickly. It was pretty easy to be like, oh, I know who each of these individual characters is. And from there, it was just a process of once we know that the cockerel plays the fiddle and is the band's, you know, PR and face, right? It's like, okay, you have that much of an archetype for each of these characters. What are the ways that they would get under each other's skin and really just butt heads with each other? And that's where the interpersonal like questions that these players ask each other as they're kind of fleshing out the relationships come into play.
Is there and maybe this is a fun little challenge, is there like a kind of if you like X, you should play X that you could give us for these playbooks?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think that the four characters have their little synopses in the book, right? It's like, okay, you know, fiddle and PR, the face, and that level of like the specificity. There's also a little bit of flavor text that players will know before they dive in to say like, oh, this is the relationship that Hound has to the situation that we're in, right? This is the relationship that Cockerel is the one who like shook the devil's hand, right? And so there's a little bit of that description baked into the text that tells people, oh, this character is going to be a flashy, loud asshole, or this character is going to be very surly and stubborn, or this character is going to be the bleeding heart of the crew. And so I think any character you play is going to be a little bit of an asshole at the end of the day, but I think it's, I guess, getting specific about what flavor of asshole you want to play over the course of the game is really up to the players and their own choice, right?
Every time I play a role-playing game, I so rarely end up playing the messy character. I guess it's just not immediately in my personality, but I can do it as a GM, but somehow when I'm a player, I'm like, I want everyone to be friends and let's all be perfect. But recently I had a chance to play Seven Part Pact by Jay Dragon. And yeah. Like, that's a game that wants you to get as messy as possible. And I'm looking forward to Last Train to Bremen of like trying to work those muscles that I don't fully have as a player. And I'm just like, make it messier. Be a bad guy. and it'll make the game more fun.
The thing about Seven Part Pact and about Bremen that they do have in common is like every single character is an asshole, right? Like it's not really possible. I guess there are some ways that you could try to spin it where it's like, oh, this character is causing all of these problems, but is well intentioned underneath the surface, right? There's ways that you can play that do soften some of that, but this is a game that really, based on like the prompting, based on getting people into these characters, we're trying to cultivate drama here. We're trying to create a situation with where this is a tinderbox, right? It's going to explode. It's going to be messy, and just giving people permission to embrace. It's like, oh, this is meant to be a little bit cathartic. It's meant to be like, oh, I can deal with this within the safety of the game, right?
And it is, speaking from just Seven Part Pact, it is fun to dive into those emotions. And I am really excited to do it in this game because I think it's got, I think it even wants you to do it maybe even, just as much, if not more than Seven Part Pact, of like, really make you bad people and see what happens.
It's fun to cause problems. It's fun to be a little asshole sometimes.
it is a thing that I have to kind of keep remembering, that like a lot of role-playing games, kind of like, you know, movies or any kind of narrative plot, is like you want problems, you want conflict. And it's so easy to fall into the trap of like, just that it's so easy to not do that actively. It's like you do have to kind of actively solve, you do have to actively create problems and conflict, but the more conflict and problems you create, the more chaotic and the more tangled the web you weave, and then solving it or playing within it gets so much more interesting and fun in a way that I have to keep it somehow, like when I go from GM brain, I'm like, yeah, keep throwing problems at them. When I go to player brain, I somehow completely forget that. And I'm like, no, let's all just get along perfectly and kill the dragon or whatever.
100%. And I think that aspect of wanting to make these characters that people can really step into very quickly and say, oh, you know, I relate to Kat because of these particular like personality aspects that I identify with, or, you know, I see the worst of myself in Kat and also the best of myself in, right? Or however it is that you relate to these characters, right? I think a lot of that comes from my work in theater, right? And knowing like, oh, this is mask work. This is about helping people have the tools to step into and embody a role as quickly as possible so that they can then like get past like, what is my motivation? What am I trying to do within this scene? And get into, how is my character feeling? How can I let the feelings inform the actions in play?
It's also a great, I feel like games like this, when it really hits, you know it, because you're able to embody a character that goes against who you are, but in a way that is safe and fun and exciting to play in like a safe, I'm really just saying I like safety tools are good and this game is good, but it is exciting to get to play in a space that you don't normally operate in. Try it on, see what that feels like. And then oddly enough, like being more involved in whatever that character trait is, like those bad ends of humanity, helps better define who you are as a person. Like you get to explore those things in a safe way and then come back and say, hey, this has actually reaffirmed the positive aspects of myself because I've now seen, I've played around in the negative aspects in a way that doesn't actually hurt anybody in a real way.
And I think that actually goes back to one of the questions you were asking earlier about like safety tools and how to make sure that people are making the most of and taking care of each other as they play. The other thing that I think really is helpful in that is Bremen is a one-shot, right? This is the game that's going to take maybe 3 hours, you know, 3.5 if you're playing long, right? Which means, okay, you only have so much time with these characters. You can say, for the next 3 hours, I am going to be channeling, you know, my petty, spiteful, resentful, all of this bad energy into this character, who we know, again, is probably going to get killed by the devil, right? It's right. Like we know that this character is bad and is, you know, probably going to have a bad ending, right? And there is something cathartic about being able to use a character who, you know, we know is damned for the pyre, right? And have that as a cathartic emotional outlet to channel some of that bad energy into, so that when we do get to the end of the game, like you're saying, Brian, we can come out and say, oh, this is reaffirming of who I am, right? You know, I'm glad that my creative partnerships aren't as bad as whatever those four had going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we've been saying a lot lately for one-shots that, like, the recommendation we remind ourselves of is drive your one-shot character like you stole it. And, like, this is a character that you're going to emotionally drive like you stole it, because there's not, like, you're not, like, doing physical conflict or anything like that. But it's like, no, I'm going to lean into the mess.
This is also drive like you stole it and the cops are right behind you. Like, yeah, you know, right. You got to move, buddy.
That's good.
Uh-huh.
As we kind of start moving towards a close in this interview, I'd love to hear from your experience playing this game and playtesting it and stories you've heard tell of. And I think this heard tell is a great way to like describe the vibe of this game somehow. I don't know why. Are there any standout moments or stories from Games of Bremen that you've played, Games of Bremen that you've heard of, that you think are emblematic of what makes a great session of Last Train to Bremen?
I think I've had the opportunity to play the game a number of times. What I often find, particularly when we're getting into memories, right, and the act of narration, like, let less be more, right? Sometimes a scene doesn't need to have a long conclusion of like, oh, this is the point that we are building to. Like, a memory can just be, here are three sentences about the relationship that we had. You know, these are the facts. This is how I felt. This is why you fucked it up. And then the other, you know, player gets to retaliate and say, I didn't fuck that up. That was actually your fault for this reason that you don't know, right? And leave it at that. It can be great to sit in the narration and expose it and be like, oh, this is where that is. But also, when you leave things a little bit shorter, it leaves a little bit of a fruitful void for people to then, in future rounds or future iterations, come back to that same idea and say, oh, I'm iterating on the exact same thing that you did in a previous memory, but I'm twisting it in a different way, and I'm going to twist the knife a little bit differently as a consequence, right? So finding ways to make memories count, you know, you only have so many of them, but not feeling like you have to really dig in super, super deep. Like the prompts alone are going to be enough to help get you most of the way there. And I think the other thing that I will say is that I've found really interesting is, I have not played a game where somebody has managed to beat the devil and win. I've heard people do it. I know that it is possible. It is designed to be winnable. It's designed to be really difficult to do, but it's possible to do. I know it's been done. And I think embracing the competitive nature that comes out when you're playing that liar's dice, like we were saying earlier, right? If you know, oh, what is the way that I want to strategize to really win this? On a mechanical level, you know, winning the game of liar's dice, but also embracing, oh, if I lose, I still get to send my character off, or I still get to, you know, have these great moments of narration in the same way. So recognizing that this is a game where you whatever way you end up losing, you still win something at the end.
Love that.
That's really good.
So, Caro, at time of recording, Last Train to Bremen has not yet launched on BackerKit. By the time this is coming out, it likely will have and hopefully is funding to the stars. But can you tell people what people can expect from the BackerKit campaign, what you can get if you back the project? And also, I'd love to hear why Possum Creek was the right partner for you for this game.
I'll start with that last question first. Possum Creek has, you know, such a near and dear place to my heart. Jay and I are definitely in conversations and, you know, bounce ideas off of each other all the time. And when I first pitched Bremen as a game, I was still very like in the process of playtesting it. Jay was like, oh, this game has juice. There's something interesting here. And so once I put it out into the world, I think very quickly on, we started talking about like what would the process of, you know, getting this to publication look like. And I explored a couple of different options. I was like, oh, there are a number of different publishers that I think could be a good match for this game in different ways, and kind of thinking about all of the different strengths and merits of each. But I think one of the things that Possum Creek cares about very intentionally is not just having a game that is a great, you know, playable object and a beautiful physical artifact, right? But making sure that those pieces are in conversation with each other, right? You flip through the pages of Wander Home, it's like, oh, this is a beautiful art book, right? You look at the boxed set of Gazebas, and it's like, oh, there is a materiality that is intentional and is underscoring what the game itself is trying to accomplish in a way that reinforces it, like, on a thematic level. Every step of the component design feels like it is very intentionally reinforcing what the game itself is trying to accomplish. And so I think that kind of segues really nicely into some of the things that we're doing with the BackerKit. Part of the BackerKit campaign, probably the biggest part, is going to be the physical book itself. The digital version of Bremen is about 30 pages. We're going to be giving it new layout and some new formatting to bring that up. It's not going to be a zine booklet. It's going to be a physical hardback book with new cover illustration by Connor Fawcett and some new, very snazzy interior illustrations. Connor's art is absolutely gorgeous. It's stunning and really drives home what we're trying to do and the themes and the vibe and the atmosphere of the game. So really, really excited to have, you know, all of Possum Creek's like art talents and chops to really bring the book home in that way. We are also going to be doing a boxed set. It's going to be a version of the book that also comes with some dice. And we're really, really excited to see how that, you know, comes together as a game that you can pull fresh out of the box and play, you know, with three friends, even if you've never read the book, trying to make that as approachable as possible.
And oof, my wallet cries yet again.
Yeah. That's so exciting.
That sounds rad.
Is there anything content-wise changing about? Like, are you adding anything to the game? Or is this like, let's bring this game to polished print?
I went back and forth on this with Jay a fair amount. I was like, is there anything else that the game needs? Like, you know, rules for a three-player variant or, you know, how to play with more or fewer? And really what we ended up landing on is like, it's solid as it is. It doesn't really need too much polish. We're going in and finessing just a couple of the small like bits and pieces to make sure that the game flows as smoothly as possible. But, you know, if you have the digital edition, it's more or less the same. It's just going to be smoothed over for ease of experience.
Caro, thank you so much for joining us for this first episode of this mini season of My First Dungeon. Do you want to tell people where they can find the BackerKit and also where they can find your other games online if they're looking for them?
Yeah, you should be able to find the crowdfunding campaign for Last Train to Bremen if you just go to BackerKit and search for Last Train to Bremen, B-R-E-M-E-N. If you want to check out any of my other games, you can find those online at C-Excursion. That's S-E-A Excursion. itch.io.
And I always love that joke every time I see your itch handle. I'm like, it's a great bit.
It's a secret riddle for anybody who takes the time to say it out loud and be like, oh, I get it.
That's really good.
And that is all for this episode of My First Dungeon. Tune in next time as we begin this tragedy of a doomed quartet. And if we're lucky, by the end of the night, one of us may still be left alive to tell the tale. And as always, remember, if you're having fun, you're already doing it right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
If you're hearing this, that means you listened to every last second of this episode. And if you simply cannot wait until the next episode drops, you should head over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod and become a member of the Dice Pool. Fresh! For just a few bucks a month, you'll get cast talkbacks, original games, and a full-length bonus actual play each and every month. As of the end of 2023, there's already over 20 hours of bonus audio, plus a whole bunch of other goodies to enjoy. So head on over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod and jump on into the dice pool. We'll see you there. Splash!